My name is Marcelino Chuong. I was born in 1957 in Manila, Philippines. My father was Vietnamese and my mother was French. My father was a Vietnam War era diplomat for the Republic of Vietnam. I grew up in Washington, D.C. when my dad was posted to Washington, D.C. And in 1961, he was called back to Saigon because President Kennedy had been elected and wanted to increase U.S. help to South Vietnam.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
When I was 18, the war in Vietnam ended in April 75, I was studying my first year. I was in my first year of political science in Paris, where I continued to study. And I became French when I was 18, because until then we had South Vietnamese nationality. After my studies, I did my military service in France, and that's where I began to consider art, or shall we say graphic art or graphic novels. It's called bande dessinée in France, as a possible career. But it took me another year of studies before I, after teaching for 1 year English in France, which is an all uphill job in those days, and probably still is, I quit teaching and became an artist. But I became a completely self-taught artist, which was a hard job. The first years were very difficult, but I struggled and held on and slowly acquired the skill needed to catch up with the others, because the level in France was very high indeed. Graphic novels, or bande dessinée as they're called, BD, the letters B and D, were a very, very big thing in France and still is. Where in the States or in England, pop music drew many talents, attracted many talents. In France, it was more arts like bande dessinée, which would attract young talents. And so I made my way in illustration also, and in graphic art, graphic novel, sorry. My latest book, which came out last October in France and has just been released on October the 3rd in North America, is called 40 Men and 12 Rifles, Indochina 1954. This time it's fiction. One might even call it a faction, because it's based on a lot of facts, but with fictional characters who themselves are, of course, based on a lot of people who lived during the French Indochina War. But the point of view I chose was to be on the Vietnamese side, and especially on the Vietnamese communist side, not because this is my political affiliation, but to try to show to the French readers, and now the English-speaking readers, to give them a glimpse of what it must have been on the other side, the certain heroism and sacrifice and bravery of many Vietnamese people who chose to fight on that side, but also the flip side of the coin, the indoctrination, the lack of freedom of expression, and also a very important thing, the very pervasive Maoist influence, Chinese influence, which was very much played down or even kept secret throughout both Vietnamese conflicts. It is only these recent years that some research has been conducted, quite often by Chinese researchers working in the States who have had access to some files in China and who are beginning to make it clear how strong the Chinese influence was. The Soviet influence we knew, but the Chinese influence was kept secret for obvious reasons, because it was felt preferable to give the world, the outside world, the impression that the communist Vietnamese were doing this all by themselves. Whereas we in the South, it was well known that we were supported by the Americans. Well, so were the North Vietnamese to an extent which had been unknown until now.
In the United States, in the diaspora, the Vietnamese community, we are, you know, it's taboo to really, from a Southern government children, to even flirt or go near anything Northern Vietnamese. It's so taboo to utter those thoughts that we could sort of get into the minds of a North Vietnamese fighters or a group of fighters. Did you ever have to put up with any diaspora contingencies that were anti viewpoints that you've taken in the graphic novel?
I really understand what you're talking about. I'm aware of this. This is probably this is typical of the Vietnamese diaspora in the States.
Yes,
and I well understand they're being allergic to anything to do with the communists. I quite understand that. I have an aunt and many cousins in San Jose and practically all over North America, including Canada, who left in difficult circumstances quite often, some of them as boat people. So I'm quite aware of the of how painful it can be for them. But you must try to see things from the perspective in France. But in France, the Vietnamese community is smaller and it is probably older. In France, the Vietnamese came in, to make things simple, in two waves. They came from very early on during the French colonial period, usually to study. I'm talking about people like my father who came to study in France. They had scholarships. My father was the son of a school teacher. He was by no means rich, but he was a clever student and hardworking. And he got a scholarship. So did his two brothers and cousins too. They came either to France or to Belgium to study. And so the community, the Vietnamese community first was formed by, let's call them scholars. Many of them were scientifics working for medicine or other trades. Then, during the wars, a lot of people moved over to France because they wanted at least one person in the family to be safe and to be able to help, I suppose, from afar. And then, as you know, the second wave came after 75 with the boat people. And sometimes these were Vietnamese of poorer classes, less educated, shall we say, but who made their way in French society. And I suppose most Vietnamese people in France stayed away from politics because they wanted to make their place in France, because they felt that they had to be discreet about that And also because in France, many French, not only progressives, but many French had a sort of sympathy or empathy for the communist side, which they saw as less corrupt. They had a very romantic image of Vietnamese communism. And I think that there may have been a very strong, or although secret or latent, guilt complex after the colonization in France, so that the sons and daughters of French colonizers or soldiers or civil servants or tradesmen, tradespeople, had a guilt complex in the 50s and 60s, and they tended to see the other side with exaggerated indulgence is a French word. They were lenience. They were very lenient with the Vietnamese communists, and they were very strict and very critical of the South Vietnamese government.
Yeah, Marcelino, I want to really emphasize this topic because it is an important aspect of Vietnamese history, that the first wave was in the 30s and 40s, would you say, from Vietnam to France?
Probably in small numbers.
In small numbers. The scholars that the Zhu Hao, which is they've gone to study, leave the country, go to France. I actually have interviewed a few people, and it is so interesting that the older generation that were in their 80s and 90s, perhaps, that did make it to France in those days, speak about their infatuation with early communism from a very socialist perspective from France. And these support personnel that were supporting the Viet Minh or the Vietnamese in Vietnam in the north were very idealistic in the way that they approached politics, and they wanted to see Vietnam free from the French and colonial rule. And as the war progressed, it seems like they became much more discontent and disenfranchised with the current in the 70s and 60s with the Vietnamese communist government. And I think the real big kicker for a lot of them was when, after the war happened, the way that the political prisoners were kept under re-education camps that really divided the French communist Vietnamese that lived in France. And this is what I'm learning, that it's very subtle. They're branded as communists, the French Vietnamese, but in reality, it's a much earlier sort of nationalistic movement. Am I correct here?
There's one thing one must understand about France and probably Italy. France and Italy are the two countries in Europe who, after the Second World War, saw the emergence of the two most powerful communist parties in Europe. Spain was another problem because, as you know, there had been the war in 1930s, from 1936 to 39, and Franco won. He eliminated all communists, and he reestablished a, we can say, pretty reactionary regime. Whereas in France, there was the occupation, the Nazi occupation, and in Italy, there was the fascist regime, which fell towards the end of the war. So both France, the state in France, collaborated with the German occupants, and in Italy there was fascism. So after the Second World War, both countries had been compromised with the extreme right. Okay, so in the immediate aftermath of that war, everyone was left-wing in France, and the Communist Party was seen as, because Stalin had led this incredible resistance against the Nazi, conducting the war for several years alone, and having lost so many people, he had this huge prestige. And this is personal, and a personal opinion. He was the new god, because at the same time, Catholicism, both in France and perhaps in Italy, decreased in its audience, probably because this modern age created that. And it was replaced in France and in Italy, both very Catholic countries before that, but Latin countries. And the Latin countries seem to need this strict discipline, because they are not disciplined, they are Latin, you know. They need this strict discipline, this Bible, this doctrine, and also this brotherhood, which a church brings, and also a party brings of the kind of the communists. They have a Bible, you know, the capital, or, you know, the manifesto, and it's a brotherhood too. So this brotherhood, this, let's call it a sect, this sect, this community replaced the humanist Christian community of the interwar period and of centuries before. Because I can't, why wasn't there a communist party in England or in Germany or in Northern Europe? Because they're Protestant, and I also think that they have this natural discipline, and they don't need such a strict rule, because they have that in them. In France, you have to put a policeman behind every Frenchman if you want him to respect the road code, you know, the road regulations. Well, for me, that's an explanation. So that when I arrived in France in 1972, coming from England, this was just 4 years after May 68, and, you know, the events in May 68, the sort of left-wing revolution in France. And you still feel that atmosphere. If you were a nice guy, you were left-wing. This had replaced being a Christian, I would say. If you were kind-hearted, if you wanted the former colonies to develop and be free, you were left-wing. It was just as easy as that, and as superficial. And I find that the French Communist Party was very influential. In 1945, 25% of the French voted for the French Communist Party, and many intellectuals and scientists were in that party, because it became a new family. They were not lonely anymore, and everyone was there. All the intellectuals, the famous guys like Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and Yves Montand and so many others, they had to be communist at one point or the other. And it took ages in France. It took Prague 68. Before that, 1956, the revelations of the Khrushchev report, for slowly French communists to realize, some of them to realize, that something was rotten in the state of Russia, of Soviet Union, and of China. And when they became wary of the Soviet Union after 1956 and 1968 in Prague, before that, in 1949, a new star had arisen in the East, and this was Mao Zedong. And that was so romantic. Look at this young guy with his long hair. He even writes poetry. That is something very seducing, seductive for the French intellectuals. This guy writes poetry. So did Ho Chi Minh, we're told. It was easy for these leaders to have someone write poetry for them and say, this is mine, you know, because this is very effective in intellectual France. So I would say, I would be more pessimistic than you, and say it took them a hell of a lot of time to realize that North Vietnam was a communist dictatorship like any other. We had to wait until 1980s, the early 1980s, when the boat people started flooding into Europe, and we heard at last the terrible news about the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. But for years, it was complete. Only the extreme right or the right wing in France understood us as people from South Vietnam. The left completely turned their backs on us. We were reactionaries. They could not understand that we were much closer to them than they thought, and much closer to them than the average North Vietnamese guy. But this is France. This is
This context is so important for the current generation, second generation diaspora like myself, because for so many years, we only kind of get one dimension as children of the Southern Vietnamese government. We see things in a very black and white, and it's, well, I'm speaking for myself. It's generally has been a tough road to see things in their nuances unless we roll up our sleeves and we get, you know, into the information and learn about these things. It has far so much implications, because there are writers now that are coming out of Vietnam that write in English about the Northern Vietnamese experience, like Nguyen Phan Quế Mai, as she writes about the mountain sings, and she writes about Dust Child, which is the Amerasian experience. And she's actually able to see it from many different sides, and the humanity that's required to really paint the picture of really basic comprehensive picture of what went on in the North. But all of that being said, it's crazy to sit here and talk to you about this, because your graphic novel addresses a point of view from the northern side, but you are a son of the southern side. And I'm wondering, how did you get to understand so much history of Vietnam? And it shows in your graphic novel, but you know, I come usually for the art, you know, a book that somebody writes, but you have like this whole history professor like personality, and it's really interesting.
I think it's a family thing. My father was a very educated man. He studied political science. I went to the same school as him in Paris, a place called the Institute of Political Studies. It's a sort of people who go on sometimes to work for the state will go first to this school. You get the best teachers there, and you get the opportunity to access really good specialists. It doesn't mean the students are brilliant, but the specialists are there. So I benefited from that. My father had all the books we had at home. Unfortunately, my Vietnamese is very poor, so I could only read in French and English. But we had all these books at home, and I would read them, or I read them later on. And also, I benefited very much from speaking with my father. I must say that I have an uncle called Trương Bưu Lâm, who is now a retired professor of history at Hawaii. He used to be a professor at the University of Hawaii. But I must say he doesn't much approve of me, because he believes that I'm, as he puts it, mixing with the wrong crowd. He believes that my stance is much too right-wing for him. Too bad, you know, I'm not a child anymore. So we both have our different visions. I respect his, and I have mine. A lot of studying, a lot of reading, and also a lot of meeting with Vietnamese people, either in France or in Vietnam. It happens that some of my father's closest cousins were on the other side. I think this is more happened more often than
Very
some
common.
people will admit.
Very
All
common.
right, well, I'm reassured that you should say that, because I find that people who can't understand one being, I'm interested on the communist side just to explode it from the inside, as it were. I don't like that side at all. It's just to show that the problem with communism is that it advances behind very seductive ideals like independence. That's, how can you resist? Freedom, ooh, fantastic. Social justice, no, I'm not against a bit of that. It depends how it's done, how it's conducted, how you get there. But if it can be done peacefully, I'm all for social justice. More equality, okay, let's try that. You see, they advance, the program is very appealing. It's almost impossible to resist, especially when you're young and idealistic. That is, there is the rub, there's the problem, because that's just publicity. It's just selling a product, but the real product you receive does not correspond to the description.
I've thought a lot about that too. What you just said, you know, the sheen, the outside is very PR friendly for the participants in their early lives. They're young and they're hungry. I mean, really hungry, and they're looking for direction. And this propaganda machine offers the best thing. But here's where I really wonder, is it a function of the culture of human beings to just become corrupt under a system of totalitarian, of a authoritarian control? And you know, you can sell, and you can believe in the selling of this propaganda as a machine, but the practical side of all of this is somebody is in control, which is one, or you know, the guys at the top are in control, and they can dish down painful edicts. They can really make your life difficult. But is that really a system of like Mao, if, or Stalin? You know, they had these ideas, but ultimately they really took advantage of these ideas, knowing that they were selling something beautiful, but there was something much more darker and sinister happening inside of Mao, inside of Ho Chi Minh or Stalin. Do you think it's more of you know, something that they use knowingly to lure the masses in?
They know what they're doing. They are manipulators. You have to love that to be a leader like that somewhere. You can be a good leader, but you have to like to manipulate this majority. But you want to lead people, all right? Well, to lead people, you direct them more or less. I think the leaders were knew what they were doing. Stalin certainly knew what he was doing, without any doubt. Maoist, I suspect, too. Ho Chi Minh, quite likely. The advantage of these guys was that they surfed on the idea of independence. They surfed on the idea of free the people from its chains. They surfed on these huge waves, this huge longing for a better life. And it is much easier to attract young idealists, young romantic idealists, as most youngsters are, with beautiful ideas. It's quite easy in a way, especially if there's an enemy at the gate or on your land, obviously from another country. It's quite easy somewhere. It's risky at first, of course, but it's easy. Now, to avoid corruption, to come back to your first point, I think the only way is a pluralistic system, political system. Without pluralism, there is no control. Look at the States. People are beginning, some people are saying it's an imperfect democracy. Well, it's better than nothing. And the Democrats and the Republicans, some people say it's the same thing. Well, I don't really agree. And at least there's some way for the American people to change. Last elections, there was a change. Now new ones are coming up. There might be another change. At least the people have the power to vote. And I'm very disappointed when I see young people saying, oh, why bother? Well, they'll see one day when there is no longer a pluralistic society, then they will understand how unpleasant it is. I often tell the French when I'm in conferences or, you know, books, what would you say if you had had the same government since 1945 or 1954, always the same party in power? Would you like that? Would you like the Gaullists to have been in power from 1945 till today, or the Socialists? No, you wouldn't. You're fed up after 2 years with your president. So, and left-wing people in France will support, well, used to. Now they're much more discreet about that. But they would support a regime which obviously had not planned for, alternance.
An alternative.
An alternative. That's not in their plans. How can they accept that when they get fed up after, you know, a few months with their government? Well, that's what we have in Vietnam. In some zones of Vietnam, which became controlled by the Viet Minh as soon as 1945, they have only known the communist regime since then. We wouldn't stand for that. So I think that although the pluralistic democracy is imperfect, it's cumbersome, it's annoying, but it's the only way to control corruption, because you keep an eye on the opposition, what they're doing. I can't see any other way of controlling things.
How did you get into becoming an artist? You're a political science student, and how did you, you know, switch to flip the switch over to art?
It was a long road. When I was young, I would draw, you know, like lots of kids, and I had this small gift. And in fact, the only drawings that have survived were the drawings I would make in Saigon, and which my mother would slip into the envelope, the airmail envelope she was sending to her parents in France, in the house, to the house where I now in Brittany. And my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, my French grandparents, kept all these letters.
Wow.
Which were very useful for me when I needed to reconstruct our daily lives in Washington, or even before that in Manila, or in Saigon, or in London. Because my mother would write practically every week. In those days, obviously, there was no email, so everything had to be handwritten. Phoning was expensive. And thanks to that, this is a sort of family archive in which my mother mentions her daily preoccupations with our school, health, children, but also mentions her husband's activities. My father was President Ian's interpreter for a long time. Every day he would go to the palace, and then he became simultaneously director of Vietnam Press. So he would talk about his job, not secret stuff, but he would talk about it a lot with my mother, and my mother would be afraid of bombs in town, things like that. So I drew as a child. And
how did your mom and dad meet?
Oh, they met in Paris when my father arrived in 1948, very shortly after. He was studying at the Sorbonne. He was reading French and English literature. And my mother was reading English literature. So the legend goes that they met. My mother was a very good-looking young girl, and my father was quite handsome, and he was a very scholarly type. And she was struggling with a Latin version. And because my father had been to school in Hue, in a school called La Providence, which was, they were French missionaries. He was quite good at Latin, which helped him in his exams, and he offered to help her. That's how they sort of, he began to court her. And they married in December 1950 during the Vietnam, the end of China War. So I would draw at home, but in typical Vietnamese families, we were expected to be good at school. Well, in our house anyway, we were expected to get top marks. And art, what's that? You know, no one ever heard about that, and no one bothered with it because it didn't seem to be to lead you to any real profession. We were sort of educated immigrants. No one was waiting for us with a red carpet. So my father had to work really hard after he left the embassy to keep us going to school, etc. And so I was good at art, but it never occurred to me that this could become a job. My mother was very artistic, really artistic, and now I realize that she was probably a frustrated artist. Right. But she was also a very busy, an overwhelmed housewife with four children, struggling against a manic depressive condition to make things worse. So I went through my studies because my father expected to me to do these things. And I also found them very fascinating, I must say. I enjoyed studies, although they were hard. They built me, you know, gave me confidence. And it was only progressively, especially during my military service, where I didn't have much to do. I was in the Navy. I was a subaltern officer, a midshipman. And we had a lot of spare time on our hands and free meals every day. So I did a lot of drawing and writing. And that's where the idea was born, that this is what I'd like to do. But when I left the Navy and said to my father, I'd like to go into comic art, he looked at me. I might have said to him, I want to be a pole dancer or something. And he said, I'm ready to help you to study another year, one further year to take this competitive exam called L'Agrégation, very prestigious thing in France. My father was a typical Vietnamese man of letters, you know, working for the state was the most noble thing to do. And I took the exam, I got it, taught for a year, I hated it. And then I allowed myself to launch into this completely new bohemian career, which was very hair-raising at first, I can tell you.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam.
No.
Because I really found it difficult.
Yes, I can only imagine. But I also am curious, you left Viet, or you were of a pretty decent age of memory when the fall of Saigon happened, and your father's position in the government was very, very high up, and life must have changed tremendously for you when you were in your teenage years as a result of the change of government at that time.
You mean the change of government in 75 or earlier
on? In 75.
At that time, my father had left diplomatic service for 11 years.
Oh, okay.
And 1970, after having, he would have three or four jobs at the same time, like many Vietnamese people in the States. Intellectual work, translations, things like that. But still, and then he in the 70s, he succeeded. He was recruited by one of the UN organizations based in London, dealing with maritime matters, and he became a translator there and had a much better salary, and things were e much easier. When Saigon, when the South fell, I was in Paris, he was in London. He was very shattered, I'm sure, for a long time afterwards, quite depressed, I think. But typically, as a typical Vietnamese father, he would not really express these things with us. But I know for sure that he would send money and parcels. We would send parcels and money to Ông Bà Nội
Vietnam.
in at that point they had moved to Vũng Tàu, Cap Saint-Jacques, French days, east of Saigon, where it was more quiet. My uncle Trương Bưu Điềm had opened a convenience store in California. He had been Vice Minister of Information under President Thieu. So things were tough. Morally, my father was extremely sad of all that, but kept it to himself, because in those days, especially in France or even England, very few people showed sympathy for the government of South Vietnam. There were some, but very few, who understood the South Vietnamese and could just simply understand. It's not very difficult to understand, but it was like that in those days, that some Vietnamese could not want to live in a communist regime. What many people did not know, and this is what I'm showing in my story, was that many Vietnamese had run into the Viet Minh in the early days in 45, 46, because at that time, the Viet Minh presented itself as an open front, at a very wide front. Just think of that in the first posters of the Viet Minh, which have some of which have survived. You can see, figures represent all walks of life. There's even a priest in a, just to show how wide they were recruiting. This was a front, this was a federation. And progressively, as the years went by and the war hardened, the resistance fighters of the early days began to realize that this was not only independence, this was revolution now we're talking about, under the Chinese influence, and the whole atmosphere was changing. So these people knew about the Viet Minh, and many of them chose to go down south in 1944, 45. And these people knew what they were talking about because they had been in the Viet Minh. Thieu had been in the Viet Minh for a few months, President Thieu. There were many like him.
So fascinating that that time period. Now, do you you grew up outside of Vietnam predominantly, and in France, you don't look Vietnamese. I mean, if I may say that without being offensive, that you
No.
don't look you don't look Vietnamese, and you have a first name that's Marcelino and a last name that's very Vietnamese. What was it like for you growing up in your early years, traveling? I mean, or being living outside of Vietnam?
I also have a Vietnamese first name, which is Luc. Luc. So my Vietnamese name is Trương Luc. We all have a Vietnamese name because after 1955, all children who had a Vietnamese father had to have a Vietnamese first name. They didn't want George or Jacques or Michel or all that. That was over. So we all had a Vietnamese first name. Mine was Luc. My brother was called Ai Mi. My sister is called Mai. We all had two names, but we were at home, we were called by our French name. My name comes from the Philippines, Marcelino. I was given the name of the street we lived in. What did it feel like growing? Well, when I was a child, I looked much more Vietnamese than I do now, I think, much more. And there was no mistake for people around me in England. For them, I was Chinese or Japanese, or I was Asian, without any doubt about that. I suppose I started to look more French as I grew up, perhaps. What did it feel like? You felt different. I really felt Vietnamese. I'll tell you a funny story. I was a British Boy Scout when I was young. I was something like 8 years old or something. I wore the uniform, the green uniform and a cap and the whole thing. I was a Cub Scout in Wimbledon. We lived in Wimbledon, South London. And one day, the day came for me to take my oath as a British Boy Scout. And when the scout leader saw me come up, he said to me, what sort of government you have in your country? Because for him, it was obvious that I wasn't English. I said, well, we have a president. And he said, well, you can take your oath to president of your country. So believe it or not, I took my oath as a British Boy Scout to the president of Vietnam. And that was President Thieu already in those days.
Wow.
Because this was being very fair play, typically English, you know.
Love it.
I could have taken my oath to the Queen of England. I wouldn't have minded, but this to show you that I looked Vietnamese when
right.
I was so it felt it was okay most of the time. Once in a while, you'd be called a ching chong, you know, in the playground, and people would pull their eyes. And actually, my brother, my older brother, he looked a bit like Dustin Hoffman. He didn't look Asian. He could have been South American or something. At one point, there was a sort of rivalry between us, and he could be quite nasty sometimes, and I would probably get on his nerves, obviously. And he would look at me and part his nostrils with his fingers and his lips, indicating to me that I looked like a gook, you know.
Wow.
Of course, I didn't like that at all. But I had to live with that. Now, in England and in France, sometimes you would, very rarely, but you would run into someone sometimes who would insult you, you know, you gook, you something like that. I was very sensitive to that. But I've never looked for someone else to fight for my causes. If someone was really obnoxious with me, I would fight back. Make it quite clear to them that, you know, I didn't like that, what they were saying. For one unpleasant word, there were 10,000 extended hands and friendly people. That's what I believe, yeah. You know.
What does it mean to be Vietnamese to today?
It means a lot to me. Although, annoyingly, my Vietnamese language is poor. I have the basics. I studied the basics from books, you know, and cassettes, but I just don't have the opportunity to practice enough. And I'm much better at German than Vietnamese. When I go to Vietnam, I love speaking with my Parisian accent. I don't think it's that bad, but I need to be in the atmosphere, and I'm shy of talking to people in the West with my Vietnamese accent. I'm afraid they're going to snicker, you know. It's very important to me for my work. I've found much inspiration in Vietnamese history or Vietnamese culture for my books, either children's books or these graphic novels I have done in my later life. For me, it's a huge source of inspiration. I even annoy sometimes my children, who are really basically French, because they find that I talk about Vietnam too much, so I sort of pipe down now. No, they think I talk about the Vietnam Wars too much. That's to be more precise, which is true. They were an obsession for me. I think we were far more traumatized, even from afar, than we would admit to ourselves. It's not because we were living, of course, I'm not saying we'd suffered as many people suffered
Right.
far more than we were safe, okay? But mentally,
Yeah.
I would identify. And today, even today, I find that, when I did my military service in France, I wanted to do it. I felt it was my duty as a Frenchman, where in those days, many people of my generation were trying to avoid it, find some way of not doing it. And you were almost considered sort of a, I don't know, a sort of right-wing conservative if you were intent on doing your military service. I wanted to do it. I felt it was a duty. And I also felt really strongly that as a citizen, if you don't want to be dominated, you have to take part in the defense of your country. And this came from my Vietnamese history. I really believe that. And I still do. I often tell youngsters, you don't realize you've been at peace for so long in
Right.
Europe that you have forgotten completely the danger of being dominated. And well, I haven't. They must think I'm an old bore, but never mind. It's very important for me. It also, as I, it's also a source of interest, I suppose, for people, I hope. You're perhaps a bit exotic. There is a definitely an upside to it also. I cook a lot, that makes friends. Well, you cook do a lot of Vietnamese cooking, French and Vietnamese cooking.
In 40 Men and 12 Rifles, can you talk about how you came up with the title of the book? Why did you name it that? And a little bit about how the book came about.
Well, it has a lot to do with what we have been talking about. I was annoyed by when I was young, when I arrived in France, I was annoyed at being, and this lasted for a long time. I was very annoyed at being lectured by usually progressive French people who were telling me who were the goodies and who were the baddies in Vietnam. And for them, obviously, the goodies were Hanoi. And it would really get on my nerves because 90.9% of the time they had never been to Vietnam. But here they were lecturing me on who was right and who was wrong. That really annoyed me terribly. And at the same time, when you listen to the French extreme right, they could be quite, I thought they had their vision of Vietnamese Viet Minh or Vietnamese resistance fighters was incomplete, was caricatural. How do you say
Yeah,
that? Caricatural
caricature.
was a caricature. They would always depict them as fanatics, a bit like North Koreans, and I would think, no, things are much more subtle than that. The Viet Minh often attracted very idealistic and brave. And when you delve into the question of the Vietnamese conflicts in France, you're sure, very sure, to very quickly hit the extreme left. Or the so-called extreme left, because I don't believe the French communists are particularly left-wing. For me, they're very conservative in a way. And you also hit the French extreme right very quickly, because the French extreme right was born from former servicemen in Indochina. Many of them, the first creators, foundators. The founders, sorry, of the French extreme right party were former professional soldiers in Vietnam, in Indochina. Why so? Because they believed, and they were certainly right in that, they were the first to confront Asian communism in Asia, and a new form of war, revolutionary war, warfare, right? Anyway, there was a lot of caricature on both sides. There was a lot of romanticism on the left side, on the left wing, and a lot of caricature on the right wing. And for me, it was helpful to have spoken to these members of my family still living in Vietnam. Many of them have died, unfortunately, of my father's generation, who gave me their point of view. Now, I wasn't necessarily convinced with what they were telling me, especially when you would look at the cracks in the ceiling and poverty around you. You would think, for all that sacrifice for what? For this? But they were sincere. They were honest. None of them were rich. None of them were corrupt, because I could see no trace of wealth anywhere. So this meant for me that they were sincere. But it was interesting to see that these were sincere people. They gave a good image, okay? So my plan for this, the idea for this book was to show that there were many generous people on the communist side, brave and ready to sacrifice many things. But beware, it's not because a people out of patriotism and propelled by a desire for independence can show great bravery and great sacrifice that the cause that they are ready to die for is necessarily good. This is what the dictatorships will have you believe. Look how many people have died for us.
Yeah.
This means our cause is fantastic. Of course it isn't. 20 million Russians died bravely, or many of them. So for Stalin, this doesn't make Stalin more acceptable. The Germans died bravely for their country in millions for a maniac called Hitler. And in China and in Vietnam, it's the same thing. It's not because people are ready to die in their millions that a cause is sanctified. Let's get rid of that idea. It's very dangerous to believe that, because these regimes often count on that. They count on the empathy they are able to arouse, in kindly Western audiences with kind-hearted people who are full of good intentions. Of course, they're suffering, but they're suffering also. That ought to be reminded. And I had to do this by delving into the Viet Minh side, by visiting it, by you know, walking with them. And some were good and some were bad.
You have a lot of courage to approach a novel in that way, because I think it takes a lot of courage to take on an opposition sort of perspective, that, you know, you and I come from a place where it's a very protected space, I think, especially in America with the Vietnamese American community.
Well, I hope they will. I hope they will
understand
to read, to try reading, you know, before judging the book by its cover. I know how painful it is for them, but they must. I was. They were. They. The elders must remember that a lot of their cousins and fathers and uncles and aunts and family at some point were in the Viet Minh too. And many of them disappointed and disenchanted, and they left. But we need to show the world what it was like.
Yeah, and I think many times it's like we don't appreciate the humanity of the sides that are in opposition to us, that it's just human beings on the other side as well. And they are in serious hot water when it comes to their judgment and doing the right thing, and you know, their convictions sort of blind them to do things that are just not things that will coincide with the ways that we view things in the South government, in the South Vietnamese government.
What I'm trying to do with this book is showing that we were legitimately fighting the communists. This is what they're like. Of course, they're nice people there. It doesn't change the reality that this is a very oppressive system. I don't know if you've ever read a book by George Orwell called A Homage to Catalonia.
No,
really
I know
good.
The book. I know the book, yes.
I love that book. He was in the war in Spain on the left-wing side with the anarchists. He described the Spanish Communist Party was ordered by Stalin in 1939 to eliminate the anarchists because Stalin had decided to sign a pact with Hitler. So we had to finish that war in Spain, all right, to have a free hand and to become very chummy with Hitler, which they became very chummy with Hitler. So Orwell describes how kind and brave and generous the Spaniards were, his comrades. But I mean, that doesn't excuse anything.
Have you looked into any book tours in the United States, in the Vietnamese community?
It's very extremely difficult, not to say impossible, for me to get away because my wife is very disabled and I am her main helper. And for me, it's very difficult to get good. Even for an afternoon, it requires a bit of organization.
Wow. How do we find the book here in the U.S.?
I suppose it's in. You can order it from your bookshop. It's for sale. You know, order it on
Amazon
from your bookshop or from that place, of course. But I always say, try to get your bookshop to work. You know, they can get it in 2 days. You know,
right.
It's nice to keep these bookshops alive, if possible.
I agree. Oh, what about the Vietnamese government? How do they view the work that you do?
I really don't know. The first two books are sold in Saigon, in French bookshops. You can get them. You can send them to Saigon. People receive them. Sometimes they get held up for a few weeks, but they pass through. I've never been invited, obviously, to talk about those books in Vietnam. The last time I was in Vietnam was in the north in 2013 to do the final research for this book and to meet three former Vietnamese officers from the lettered class, and all three of them, no, especially two of them, without me. For once, I listened and shut up, you know, not like now. And I was there to hear them. And I didn't prompt them at all. And two of them said to me, after some time, all our troubles began when the Chinese Maoists got involved in the Viet Minh and took things over and sort of made us adopt their land reform and their doctrine, and the atmosphere changed overnight and became terrible. And it's still going on now. That's what they told me, you know. So that was the last time I went. And now, as you know, on Facebook, I'm quite active on Facebook. This is the lonely man's pastime, the lonely worker's pastime. And I've noticed that there's For the other book, sometimes I'd be quite vocal, you know. I sort of calmed down, but I would get flak. Do you know the word flak?
Yeah.
Anti-aircraft.
Yep.
Fire from these guys posing under a false identity, a fake French name or a fake American name, who are probably in Hanoi behind a laptop. And who were Their mission was to keep an eye on what was being said on the social networks. And so I would be criticized by these guys who would say things like, how dare you question the victory of the Vietnamese people in 1954? And I would say, who said I was questioning? I never have I ever questioned that victory. Of course they won. What I'm questioning is the way the story is being told by the official line. And every generation questions the official storyline, and this is what I'm doing. But right now, complete silence. And I think perhaps that is a way of them for to try to pretend I don't exist. Perhaps, I don't know. Maybe they don't care at all, and
And maybe they're just more
I'm
open today.
that I don't know, not the officials, I don't know, I don't think so, but maybe they don't care a fig about me, and I just think I'm much more important than I really am. I don't know. I can't. I have some fears about going back to Vietnam sometimes, because you will have people who will tell you, "Oh, no problem," and others will tell you, "Be careful. You might be beaten up on some street corner by two civilian guys, you know."
Yeah,
I don't know.
I think that was very 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I don't think that that really exists today. I think if you're not loud about propaganda coming from the West, then you're not really in their face. They typically are just very relaxed. And I think the people that run Vietnam today are very modern, and it's opening up to a lot more academic freedom at the university level. A lot of the kids that were coming from kids of government officials in the 90s and the 2000s were sent to the United States for Ivy League educations. They were going to really good schools, and many of them returned home and, really are making big influences in the government and in the private business sectors. So I think that there is reform, but it's very slow and very steady. They're not trying to overthrow the government. It's working at a natural, organic clip.
I'm glad to hear that. I actually have cousins who went to study, who live in England now. The grandsons of this uncle of mine in South Vietnam, who was a member of Parliament and who was in the National Liberation Front. One of his grandsons is living in Birmingham, and one of his granddaughters went to study in Manchester, I think. So they speak English fluently. And I'm glad to hear what you're saying. I hope things evolve.
Yeah, there's progression. There's not it's not at a standstill. Not at all. I was at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I was on a panel discussion for Vietnam Week last week, and somebody asked about censorship and Facebook and Twitter and all of these social media apps being censored by the government. And I said, there's a lot of progress, but if you don't like the way that these things are handled, these are things that eventually will work itself out. It's not our house. It's our uncle's house. It's not our house. We can do whatever we want in our house, and we can do whatever we want in our country, and we can affect change the way we want, and we can continue to grow the way we want. But when it comes to Vietnam, there is a progress. There's a method to what they do, and it is slowly reforming and changing. But there's no re need to rush it. That's just my opinion. We will get eventually to a place where it'll resolve itself.
I certainly hope so. I'm all for a peaceful evolution. I'm certainly not calling for a violent overturn, whatever it's called. Certainly not. I hope I just hope that we will move towards a more pluralistic society, politically. That's what I mean. Because it seems to be just good sense. You need to have a voice for an opposition.
Marcelino, I we got to touch a little bit upon your early life and the book, but I feel like I can speak to you a lot about different just historical points throughout the history of Vietnam, but that re would require a whole episode of a student to teacher in our situation. I think that I would need a lot more time to focus on different aspects of Vietnamese culture as it even relates to French society and the diaspora in France?
Well, you know, I have to do a lot of reading for all this, so I need to catch up on certain things. I don't pretend to know everything by any means. I just research when I do a subject. You know, there are huge areas I know nothing about.
Yeah, I want to end on this question. What are you writing next? What are you thinking about next?
After, you know, this job took me 3 years, and if you knew how much my advance on rights was, you'd snicker. I actually received, and this is general. It's the book world is like that. Unless you're someone really famous who sells a lot, it's a product, you know. So you get larger advances on rights if you sell a lot. Okay, if you don't, you just receive what they will give you.
Yeah.
And three years of solid hard work, very fascinating hard work for 15,000 euros. So I let you calculate that. And I have to sell 6,333 copies for me to have
royalty.
Paid up that sum that was given to me, and to expect royalties at the rate of €2.31 per book sold, once I have sold 6,333. This is the book world. I'm not complaining. This is how it happens. So, which makes me sort of reluctant to run into a new job, which is going to take me a lot of time, or I must be able to control its length. This book wasn't supposed to be that long. I just got not carried away, but I did this as it came along without much planning and a lot of anxiety and fear along the way, hoping it would not bore people to tears, you know. And if I do another one, it has to, if I want to survive, it would have to be 110 pages, which was the original mission.
Yeah.
Something like that. And my publisher is eager for me to do a new book because this book is working well. It's not a landslide, but you know, in our conditions here, it's obtained great critical acclaim. And he would like me to go back even earlier, back to the days of the conquest of Indochina, the late 19th century. So I don't know. For instance, for the moment, I'm working on a book which has nothing to do with Vietnam. It's about the beach, the sea, swimming pools. Well, I will mention the swimming pool in Saigon, the Cercle Sportif swimming pool, where I used to go as a child. But I may go back to the graphic novel because it's a fascinating job. You don't earn a cent, but you control everything. You do everything from A to Z, which is hard work, but at least you don't have to rely on someone else.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
So it's pretty exhilarating, but really hard work. And it's a marathon, you know, you're at it for days.
Yeah.
Maybe the early conquest, but this time again, I want to show it from the Vietnamese side, principally. Because the other side is known to the French reader,
right.
Or better known.
Well, Marcelino, thank you so much for coming on tonight. I know it's very late there. And I value the work that you do because, you know, I know the publishing world and, you know, the advances are, you know, it's really bad, but we do it for the love of the culture, and we do it for the love of history and all of the things that are creative about our lives. So I appreciate it. And I will, you know, hopefully everybody picks up the book.
Thanks for your talk. And I'm glad you're the first one I talked to. And I'm glad, sorry, I was nibbling something. I'm glad it's a Vietnamese guy. Because what I haven't said is that I'm really happy when I meet up with a Vietnamese friend. You ask me if I feel Vietnamese. Well, I can tell you I really do when I meet up with a Vietnamese guy, or
yes.
because there's a sort of immediate complicity. What's the word?
Yes. Connection.
Connection. We've been through these things, and something I don't necessarily get with all these French friends I have.
Right.
So it was really starting with you.
Thank you so much, Marcel, for the opportunity. Have a wonderful evening.
Same to you.
Okay.
Bye, Kenneth.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.